your back. AU offers more than 850 courses that align to your program, so you can retake your course online, turn that grade around, improve your GPA, explore new subjects, and study from anywhere. Visit athabascau.ca to browse our online courses and transform your education today.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Queen's Law Pro Bono Radio. My name is Maeve McNaughton and I will be your host this week. I'm a 1L student here at the Queen's University Faculty of Law and have the privilege of working with the Queen's Chapter of Pro Bono Students Canada to discuss new and emerging legal topics in an accessible format. This week, we'll be looking at new and emerging legal methods of environmental protection, focusing on environmental personhood and ecocide. It's no secret that climate change is one of, if not the most serious and imminent threat to society. I won't relay the terrifying statistics that I'm sure we all know, but long story short, the Earth and its environment is in trouble. Unfortunately, rather than being able to rely on the cooperation and understanding of fellow humans, it's looking like the imposition of legal liability may be necessary to forcefully stop the destruction of the environment that we depend on. The only common law way to protect, say, a stream from destruction has been to establish that another human has had their property rights infringed upon. This human-centric approach fails to recognize the symbiotic relationship of humans and nature. Harming a natural entity, even if not directly infringing upon a human's legal rights, inevitably will cause harm, not only to one human, but many. As French philosopher Bruno Latour points out, society has created a false boundary between nature and culture. We look at global warming and think of it as separated into people, politics, and science, when really it's a hybrid of everything, of one thing. Humans themselves are nature, and vice versa. In 2007, the Government of Canada adopted the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, also known as UNDRIP. The declaration, aimed at affirming the inherent right of Indigenous people around the world, provides several rights regarding land, natural resources, and environmental protection. Some of these include Article 25, which states that Indigenous peoples have the right to maintain and strengthen their distinctive spiritual relationship with their traditionally owned or otherwise occupied and used lands, territories, waters, and coastal seas, and other resources, and to uphold their responsibilities to future generations in this regard. There's also Article 26, which states, 1. Indigenous peoples have the right to lands, territories, and resources which they have traditionally owned, occupied, or otherwise used or acquired. 2. Indigenous peoples have the right to own, use, develop, and control the lands, territories, and resources that they possess by reason of traditional ownership or other traditional occupation or use, as well as those which they have otherwise acquired. And 3, states shall give legal recognition and protection to these lands, territories, and resources. Such recognition shall be conducted with due respect to the customs, traditions, and land tenure systems of the Indigenous peoples concerned. Finally of note is Article 29, which states that Indigenous peoples have the right to the conservation and protection of the environment and the productive capacity of their lands or territories and resources. States shall establish and implement assistance programs for Indigenous peoples for such conservation and protection without discrimination. UNDRIP was the basis of a 2023 resolution passed by the Assembly of First Nations of Quebec-Labrador, composed of the chiefs of the 43 First Nations. The resolution, which was made in 2021, recognizes legal personhood for the St. Lawrence River system and affirms the attention of the AFNQL to be part of legal decisions impacting the river. The resolution refers to the rights of Indigenous people as laid out in the UNDRIP and asserts that the St. Lawrence River system falls under the territories subject to the declaration as it has been vital to their culture and economy for centuries. The resolution is focused on the threats being faced by the river and those who depend on it, including ecosystems and endangered species. The AFNQL assert themselves as legal guardians of the St. Lawrence River system and recognize it as having legal personhood. This resolution is a first step towards obtaining legal personhood for the St. Lawrence River, as it signifies a willingness by Indigenous leaders to be active in the legal processes required to protect the river. So, what is legal personhood, and how can a non-person have it? As put by Gwendolyn Gordon in her paper on the topic, environmental personhood is, quote, the nascent notion of designating parts of nature as legal persons entitled to independent regard and consideration. This concept of legal personhood, as said by John Dewey, quote, signifies what the law makes it signify. What it really means changes based on jurisdiction, context, etc. In the context of environmental personhood, it essentially allows a piece of nature to hold, defend, and owe rights just like a person. The idea of extending legal personhood to non-persons is not unique to environmental structures. Legal personhood has been extended to corporations since the Middle Ages, allowing a non-human entity to sue, be sued, enter contracts, and more. The Magpie River in the Côte Nord region of Quebec, known to the Innu First Nation as Matehekoshipu, is the first natural feature to gain legal personhood in Canada. The river, which has been a sacred part of Innu culture for centuries, has faced the looming threat of dams for hydroelectricity. Such dams would disrupt the natural flow of the river, consequently threatening the fragile ecosystems that depend upon this consistent flow for survival. In response, the Innu Council and Mangani Regional County Municipality worked together to give the river legal personhood in 2021. This monumental moment in Canadian environmental protection gave the river 9 rights. The right to flow, the right to respect for its cycles, the right for its natural evolution to be protected and preserved, the right to maintain its natural biodiversity, the right to fulfill its essential functions within its ecosystem, the right to maintain its integrity, the right to be safe from pollution, the right to regenerate and be restored, and finally, the right to sue. One major issue in protecting the environment via legal personhood that you may have already noticed is that it requires legal guardians to sue on behalf of the structure in question, as well as someone to invest time and money in pursuing litigation on behalf of it. In Ecuador, for example, the Global Alliance for the Rights of Nature was successful in a lawsuit against a construction company to protect a river. When the company failed to follow through with the court ruling, however, the alliance had no money left to take them back to court. In the sphere of international law, discussion is turning towards internationally criminalizing ecocide, defined by the Independent Expert Panel for the Legal Definition of Ecocide as, quote, unlawful or wanton acts committed with the knowledge that there is a substantial likelihood of severe and either widespread or long-term damage to the environment being caused by those acts. Several proponents of criminalizing ecocide would like to see ecocide recognized as the 5th international crime to go along with the current 4 of genocide, crimes against humanity, war crimes, and the crime of aggression. If adopted by the state's parties, ecocide would become the first international criminal law to target a wrong that does not require direct and severe harm to humans. Just like legal personhood, however, there are of course barriers to internationally criminalizing ecocide, among them being determining the fault requirement. Specific intent is not appropriate because most perpetrators do not commit ecocide with the intent of harming the environment. Lower fault requirements, such as strict liability or criminal negligence, on the other hand, may not be sufficient to justify the severity of international criminalization. Some have pointed out another flaw in that the International Criminal Court may not be the most efficient forum for prosecuting ecocide. The already overwhelmed ICC would not have the capacity to hear a significant number of cases regarding ecocide. Professor Daryl Robinson, in his article on The Puzzles and Possibilities of Ecocide, suggests an alternative. A widely accepted convention, which is accepted by parties and incorporated into individual domestic law. Although no such convention exists yet, several countries have taken matters into their own hands and are beginning to criminalize ecocide nationally, the most recent of these being Belgium, which approved a penal code recognizing the crime of ecocide in February of 2024. Despite growing support, Canada has not yet recognized ecocide in its criminal code. Between the emerging use of environmental personhood and the possible future recognition of the crime of ecocide on both a national and international scale, there really is no foolproof legal method to protect the environment. Current and proposed solutions all have their downfalls. The conversation really comes down to which is the best method rather than which one is perfect. Here to discuss that with me today is Professor Daryl Robinson. Professor Robinson is a professor at the Queen's University Faculty of Law, specializing for over 25 years in international criminal justice. He earned a Minister's Citation and Minister's Award for Foreign Policy Excellence for his role in the negotiation of the Rome Statute and Canada's Crimes Against Humanity Act. Professor Robinson has dozens of publications on international criminal law. More recently, he's been involved in research regarding internationally criminalizing ecocide as part of the UCLA Promise Institute project, a project to consider the use of international criminal law in protecting the environment. Thank you so much for coming on here today to talk to me about ecocide. It's exciting to have somebody with so much experience firsthand in the development of ecocide in Canada and internationally.
Happy to be here.
So I will just jump right into the questions. So the first one is, branding someone as a criminal requires a grave standard of wrongdoing, especially for international crimes. If adopted, ecocide would be the first international crime that does not require serious and direct harm to human beings. So could you speak a bit to why you do or don't believe that environmental harm meets the standard?
I think it definitely does meet the standard. In criminal law, we split things up into two kinds of crimes: regulatory offenses, which are considered minor, and it's mostly just fines. And then criminal law, which we use for the most serious things, where we really want to condemn them. Environmental harm has long been considered just regulatory. So businesses will often deliberately do it and just absorb any fines as the cost of doing business. So we're not really taking environmental harm seriously enough. The idea of ecocide, it's going to be a crime that just deals with the absolute worst environmental harm, like things that cause widespread, long-term, severe damage. And I think that totally belongs in criminal law and even in international criminal law, because these are the kinds of harms that are going to hurt like entire communities of people. It jeopardizes the health of present generations of humans and future generations of human and then other animals. So I think that's the signal, is causing this kind of harm indirectly to the environment belongs at the very top of the things that we condemn as criminal.
So you also mentioned in your previous work on ecocide that amending the ICC statute to add ecocide might not be the best way to establish a crime of ecocide. Could you expand a bit on why that is and how domestic courts may be a preferable forum?
Right. I'm all in favor of every way to make ecocide happen. But a lot of people are focused on adding it to the International Criminal Court statute. And I'm fine with that if and when it can be done. But there's a bunch of hurdles to do that. You have to get a supermajority of the ICC states parties to agree to it. And even if you succeed, the International Criminal Court, it's just one court, it's one forum that's already pretty overloaded with the cases that it has. So that's why I personally, I like both ways, but I favor trying to get it passed into legislation in as many countries as we can. And it's working. Parliaments are thinking about ecocide and they're starting to adopt crimes. There's this wave of them. And so my vision is, if we can get 80 countries to adopt this law, then we have all the courts of 80 different countries working away on ecocide. And then someday, yeah, of course, we'll add it to the International Criminal Court too. But my thinking is national level first and then the international.
I know this isn't really your area of specialty, but we did touch a little bit earlier on legal personhood being granted to environmental structures. I just wanted to get your thoughts on, do you think criminalizing ecocide in Canada is preferable to granting legal personhood to environmental structures? As in, do you think that the criminal courts are the best way to handle this rather than civil courts? And if so, why?
I think my answer is, let's do both. The environmental crisis we're facing, it's really a complicated picture, and let's use every tool we have. I think criminal law and civil law and all kinds of other mechanisms, they can go together, they can be complementary, they can do different things. A lot of really cool things are happening with legal personhood of nature in Canada and other countries. And there's an overlap between that and ecocide. To put two, I don't remember if you've already covered these two words, but anthropocentric and ecocentric. Anthropocentric means we're focusing on humans and human interests. Ecocentric means protecting nature as an end in itself. So both these movements, the legal personhood of nature and ecocide, they have that in common. They're both ecocentric. So ecocide says, let's protect nature as an end in itself. I guess I should also say, I turn to criminal law because I'm a criminal law person, but I think that criminal law is only a very, very small piece of this puzzle. Criminal law can express the values of a society. And I guess that's the message I want to give, is that massive environmental harm, it's not just a regulatory offense the way we've been considering it. So I like the idea of criminal law to signal that we condemn this as one of the most serious harms that anybody can do. And so my vision one day is a board of directors standing nervously around the table saying, well, is this ecocide? And backing off. So that's the role that criminal law can play, is signaling this is not just regulatory, this is not business as usual, it's actually a really bad thing. But criminal law will be one small little piece of the puzzle, and there will be civil law, environmental law, and then all kinds of non-law things too, like we have to change our cultures, technology, society. There's all kinds of changes we have to do.
Okay, and then the last question is a bit of a two-parter. So first of all, is a crime of ecocide, in your opinion, just an aspiration, or is it likely to actually become a reality in the near future?
Yeah, great. Yeah. It is moving surprisingly quickly. When I talk to government officials, at first they would smirk a little because ecocide is, they consider it kind of pie in the sky. It is moving so fast. I'm used to things in international sphere take a decade or two decades or three to go anywhere. Ecocide is happening really quickly. There's a wave of legislation is happening. The European Parliament has adopted something telling all the European Union member states to go pass ecocide laws. Belgium's done something, France has done something, other countries like in Latin America, like Brazil, they're doing something. So it's moving at lightning speed. It's happening. It's not just a vision or a dream or an aspiration. It's coming.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned that. I actually had to update the script because as I was writing it, the Belgium law came out.
Right.
So it's definitely evolving very quickly.
Yeah. Yeah, too hard to stay on top of.
Yeah. And finally, do you foresee Canada adopting ecocide or a similar crime into the criminal code in the near future? And why or why not?
You know, I hope that Canada will one day be joining this wave. At this moment, Canada is not really part of the wave. Canada has not done a lot on the international front or on the domestic front. I think their position is something like Canada follows this matter with interest, which is kind of a bystander thing to say. So I think Canada probably is going to need the comfort of seeing other countries do stuff. And then there's going to need to be a public push, which will then lead to a political push. And I do think Canada is going to join the club, but we'll have to nudge them.
Yeah, I agree with that. Canada likes to do things last, I've noticed.
Yeah, a little bit. It used to be Canada used to be more of a leader, but we've become a little bit cautious.
Awesome. Well, that's all my questions. Was there anything else you want to add?
No, that was great.
Thank you, Professor, for chatting with me today and sharing your insights on this fascinating topic. The future of legal environmental protection in Canada is in the midst of huge changes, and I'm sure we're all excited to see what happens next. Attitudes around the world seem to be changing from viewing nature as a resource to exploit into a symbiotic, coexisting entity of its own that we share this planet with. Whether you view natural entities like this or not, the fact remains. We depend on these environmental structures to survive. Harming them will inevitably harm us. However it happens, hopefully Canadian and international legal systems can quickly come to a consensus on the importance of legally protecting natural structures before they're destroyed. Just one final reminder before we sign off for the day, this podcast does not contain legal advice. Pro Bono Students Canada is a student organization. This podcast was prepared with the assistance of PBSC Queen's Law student volunteers. PBSC students are not lawyers, and they are not authorized to provide legal advice. The podcast contains a general discussion of certain legal and related issues only. If you require legal advice, please consult a lawyer. Once again, I am your host, Maeve McNaughton, and thank you so much for listening to this week's episode of Pro Bono Radio here at the Queen's University Faculty of Law.
Joining us here today for the visit of Alyssa Phillip Gentry. I want to start, of course, just by acknowledging that we're here today gathered at Queen's Faculty of Law, which is situated on the traditional territories of the Anishinaabe and the Haudenosaunee. And when we acknowledge the traditional territory, we're acknowledging a long-standing relationship that predates the arrival of Europeans and colonialism and extends into the present day. And we just want to express our gratitude that we're here today gathered, learning, listening, and finding out all about contextual informed consent together. All right, so just a little bit of an introduction for people about Alyssa. You can see I've got this lengthy introduction. I'll hit the highlights so that we still have time for the paper. Alyssa is the Kevin Wood and Mary Jo Pede Professor at the Florida State University College of Law. She also has an appointment in the economics department, and you're still an associate with the Department of Economics in Toulouse, right?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, right. So she is a very interdisciplinary scholar. Her JD and PhD are in law and economics that she got at Vanderbilt. And I think it was Kip Biscusi was your supervisor, right? So for anybody who's interested in risk regulation or value of fiscal life, this is a very famous guy. So we have a very famous empiricist here with us, right? A lot of Alyssa's work is empirical. That's mostly how I've gotten to know her, by looking at her work and reading her work, which is mostly focused on health law, right? Health law, risk regulation, some stuff on sort of workplace regulation in the context of health risks as well. So there's a really interesting body of work that she's got. There's a lot of stuff on drug regulation, medical devices, She publishes in all kinds of really interesting interdisciplinary places. So Journal of Risk Regulation, the Journal of Empirical Legal Studies. She does do stuff for lawyers that don't know numbers, some of which I think we're going to sort of see today, right? But I think that is sort of a crossover, again, sort of a lot of it on medical, med-mal, and tort concepts and tort law. Did I get it?
Yeah.
That's pretty close.
That's great.
That's close. Okay, good. Oh, great. Okay. I'm just really, really delighted to be able to have her here to share her work. She really is an extraordinary scholar. Her work hits these interdisciplinary areas that matter a ton to workers, patients, processes for thinking about regulating in the health space, innovation in healthcare, right? So it's really wonderful to be able to have her here to share this ongoing work with us. And yeah, just for us to be able to meet her and have a chance to engage. So Alyssa, take it away. And usually I don't know if we covered this, but usually we'll have our presenter just go ahead and present, and then we'll do Q&A afterwards. But it's totally up to you how you prefer to run.
Yeah. Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me. This is really a pleasure. This is an early work in progress, so I love feedback. Anything you can do to kind of push me on my arguments. As Sherry said, this is a non-empirical work. And so this is going to be, you know, something that I would really appreciate a lot of feedback on and just thoughts in general. I'm aware that I am not really well versed in Canadian law, and I am presenting on a very English, US law topic. So insofar as there anything that I can clarify, please just ask questions in the moment, because I think that's the best way to do this. And of course, we'll do questions after, but feel free to just jump in and ask. And I'll just get started. So the idea behind this project is that informed consent is a huge part of US health law. We allow for a lot of lack of regulation because we assume that physicians are going to be these intermediaries and effectively educate patients in what would be what they would prefer to do if they had an MD degree, if they were able to navigate that gap in the education to understand what is best for themselves. But the question is, how true is that? And particularly, how true is that in context where there's a high level of uncertainty and this room for behavioral biases, which I will cover in this presentation? So my context in thinking about this is fertility treatment, but you can think about other contexts in which a similar bias could be triggered, in particular, end-of-life care, palliative care, contexts in which treatment experience and treatment failure can temporarily change your willingness to accept risks and costs. And in that way, you might express preferences or in fact be ratcheted up in your willingness to accept risks and costs asymmetrically, only up, in ways that you might not find acceptable in other times. And since we assume that informed consent is something, a doctrine that is helping us navigate these issues more generally, it's not at all suited or required to address this behavioral bias. And so I'm going to focus on context like that and see if there's something else that we can do to effectuate the goal of informed consent while remedying some of the weaknesses that it definitely has. All right, so the first thing I want to talk about here is, as my example, assisted reproductive technology. This is a context that's very much characterized by uncertainty. So the first uncertainty that patients will have is, you know, what is the probability of unaided conception? And this is largely determined by age, but not entirely. And I note in the paper, there's this burgeoning market of home fertility tests, and it's unclear how effective they are, how informative they are. Some doctors are really skeptical of this, and they're concerned that they heighten anxiety for people without providing a lot of good context. And so this is a context in which physicians would be very helpful. The testing that they do creates a learning process for both the patient and the physician. But this learning process is not symmetric. A patient comes in not knowing, their unaided probability of conception. And through the series of tests, they only learn through what the physician tells them, right? And the physician, having a lot more experience with this, can more readily classify a patient into a perceived likelihood of successful implantation based on not only that patient's scores and results, but all their other history and their own medical education. So this is a context in which asymmetric information looms large, and the ability of a physician to communicate medical information and to patient-specific medical information is important. The other thing here is that, I'll move on. The other uncertainty here is treatment efficacy. So for fertility treatment, there's actually a bunch of services, medical procedures. And in the US, there's no approval process for a medical procedure. There's no FDA equivalent for a procedure. The only guide on physicians is really medical malpractice. And so while some agencies have best practices, and we're actually going to talk about some of these digests that have come out, there's no regulatory compliance as confidence that come with this. So a lot of times they're practicing correctly innovative treatments. They're trying new procedures, finding higher success rates, but there's also, with that novelty, higher uncertainty. Even when drugs are used in the fertility context, they're often used in an off-label context. So a lot of the hormones or drugs that are activating hormones are used not for their approved purposes, but for other purposes. And that doesn't mean that they're wrong. It just means that there's no regulatory board that has said there is absolutely general evidence of average efficacy for this treatment. So not only, even if we think about patient fit, which is another layer of complication on top of things, there's just a lot of uncertainty about the treatments available. So it's a lot of patients trying to understand their options and the relative benefits of each of these options. And of course, providers are a big part of that as well. The other thing, one more thing I'll say about treatment efficacy is we tend to be really down on uncertainty, but this is a context where uncertainty might be amazing for patients to experiment with. So the benefits of experimentation is something I think about in my other work. Sometimes when, depending on the options out there, you can learn quite a lot from experimentation, especially if you experiment over multiple periods and you're able to discontinue bad treatments and learn what fits you better. On average, you can actually do better by engaging with these in certain treatments. But again, you have to know, you have to get good information. You have to communicate that uncertainty effectively. And that's something that physicians have difficulty doing. So some of my other work with Kip actually is exploring how do we get people to communicate correctly the value of imperfect data, uncertain treatments. And that's an incredibly thorny subject. So that's part of the issue with treatment efficacy. The last thing I'll say is, costs are uncertain. And that's simply because you only continue with fertility treatment if you don't have a successful implantation. So it's a sequential treatment, and I don't know how many of these rounds I'll go through. So the cost, even if they aren't, if they're just round by round, they are uncertain because I don't know how many rounds. There are a lot of mechanisms that have evolved to address the uncertainty in costs. So people are generally not happy, don't enjoy uncertainty in costs or risk in costs. And so we have financing techniques to help with this. And what I'll talk about in this paper is sometimes these financing techniques actually don't address the things that they're suggesting they're going to address. They don't increase access, which is one thing that financing techniques might do. And they don't help risk aversion. So if I don't want to gamble over the amount of money I'm going to spend on this treatment, because I don't know how many rounds I'll have to go through, I might be willing to pay a lower and set amount of cost for a number of these bundles. And that would be a very traditional way of dealing with risk aversion. A consumer might prefer to buy a bundle rather than gamble on the number of rounds they have. But the treatment, the financing techniques that have evolved in the space try to say that they're addressing risk aversion, but they actually might be doing something different. So this is a context where there's room for, I wouldn't say predatory, but definitely not addressing some of the concerns triggered by these uncertainties. So we've talked about informed consent and the fact that it exists. It's supposed to be this bulwark of protection for patients. Why is that not true? So in order to bring an informed consent claim in the US, you have to prove that the physician owed you a duty to disclose that, and that because they breached their duty, you both would have made a different decision. So this is one causation. I would make a different medical decision if I had that disclosure. And then the second causation requirement is that different decision would have prevented my injury. So this double causation requirement ends up being kind of a big barrier for patients to overcome generally. And it's tougher in the fertility context. So in general, when courts think about the duty to disclose, they construe it relatively narrowly. So there are two big standards in the US. One is the reasonable patient standard. If I were a patient, if a reasonable patient with the attributes that my patient has were to find something material, then I should disclose it. That's about half the courts like that. The other half say it's only what a reasonable physician would disclose. And you can see that there perhaps potentially more paternalism baked into that. So if a real physician wouldn't disclose some other attributes of the treatment or even this behavioral bias, that's really not going to fly. And in general, courts have construed this disclosure requirement really narrowly. So in managed care systems where a physician actively makes more money, the less he prescribes. So I get a pot of money to treat a patient, and every treatment that I prescribe comes out of that pot of money. And so I have a real financial incentive to underprescribe. Courts have basically said, that's really not part of the disclosure. That's not relevant to a patient. It's not something a patient needs to know. So in terms of non-scientific data, courts really don't seem to care, or they want to narrowly construe this disclosure requirement. The second issue here is that you have, of course, this double causation requirement. And for a fertility patient, that would basically mean that they have to prove that if I didn't know this information, if I did know this information that I didn't get at the time, I would have chosen not to have this treatment. And then they'd have to say, without that treatment, I would have had pregnancy. I would have successfully implanted. And that is a tough sell. That is probably not going to line a jury. The injury is not really well suited to the common law suit that is bringing up. So first, juries might not believe that in this heightened emotional context, there'd be anything you wouldn't do to actually have this additional treatment. But also you'd be kind of making the claim that without treatment, you'd be more likely to have a pregnancy. If you brought suit just for the lost money that you spent on it, recovery is very limited. There's almost no recovery for just pure economic loss. So recovery for patients in this context is severely limited. And yet we think of informed consent as this protective element, but if no one's bringing suit, it doesn't matter. So how much does this really incentivize physicians to bring suit? No, sorry, to provide that kind of education? The thing this paper will add to on top of this list of deficiencies is informed consent is not at all tasked with or addresses potential changes in preferences that might be temporary. So if the course of treatment triggers in a patient the willingness to accept higher costs or more extreme risks, risks that they previously would have found unacceptable, that phenomenon is never meant to be highlighted by a physician. It's never part of their scope of the disclosure. And but if it exists, and there seems to be studies that suggest that they would, it would be very important to a patient's choices. So what do I mean by experience-sensitive disclosures or preferences? What I'm not saying at all here is that we have any sort of correct preference. I'm not at all saying that anyone's trade-off between money and a chance at pregnancy or risk and a chance at pregnancy is incorrect, because theoretically, I don't know that there is a bound on that. All we're saying here, it's also not saying that learning about new treatments and updating my beliefs about what I prefer is wrong. In fact, I think that's incredibly rational. The more I participate in fertility treatments, the less dread I potentially have about the treatment more generally. I might be willing to participate more generally. I might realize that my fit with those treatments are different than I expected, and I might be more willing to pursue some treatment but not other. we fully believe that in a rational process, your preferences will change. The one thing that we don't want is the fact that a treatment failure has been experienced changes my willingness to accept a cost or a risk. That is the only thing I'm suggesting with experience-sensitive preferences. And as you might think, that's almost inextricably tangled up with learning. That's difficult. It's hard for me as a regulator to say, well, these choices are driven by an experience-sensitive preference versus learning about the technology, learning about my own biological state and what I would need. And for that reason, a really soft touch from regulation is necessary. Crude, broad regulatory restrictions would be very problematic in this context, because from looking at a patient's preferred preferences over treatment, there's no way for an external person to say, that's irrational, this is rational. So just before we move on to kind of see how we would address this, I just want to emphasize, this is really about preventing what I think about as like a progressive escalation of acceptable risks and costs. I think in the beginning of the paper, I said, when a patient thinks that, well, this new treatment, I've already spent like $50,000 for 3 rounds of IVF. And this new round is really small proportion of the total amount that I've spent so far. That's an argument that will only get more persuasive the more you spend. So after I've now spent, you know, $62,000, it's an even smaller proportion of the cumulative harm. So there's no built-in limit there. Same thing with risk. And it's this progressive asymmetric ratcheting that I'm concerned about. All right, so there are two contexts where I think either, well, I mean, trigger this and also show that that experience-sensitive preferences might be important. So the first is this idea of innovative treatment. So we have all these treatments with uncertain efficacy. And the question is, one, how do patients receive information that is inherently uncertain? How do we communicate the value of ambiguous risks, ambiguous benefits? So that's kind of other work that I do on this, and I'm happy to chat more about that in the Q&A. But just also in general, before we get to that, actually, I think a great example of that has been the Human Fertilization Embryology Authority, and they rate IVF add-ons. So when you go through a round of IVF, you have the option to include other procedures along with implantation. So assisted hatching is something where technically, and this is all new to me, technically,
it sounds really scary.
It does. It is.
I'm already dreading it.
I mean, I have a picture of it and it looks horrifying. You have an embryo and it technically hatches. And so one of the thoughts was, we can have more successful implantation if we assist in the hatching. So they put a chemical on the outside of the embryo that kind of dissolves the barrier and it assists in the hatching. And it's called assisted hatching. And it's one of the many add-ons you can add to fertility implantation round. And unfortunately, none of them have actually been rated green. And so green here says that there's active, rigorous evidence of efficacy and safety. Yellow said something like unclear, and red says no evidence of efficacy. Now, unfortunately, no evidence of efficacy could mean two things. It could mean no study's been done, or it could mean studies have been done and we're unable to find proof of efficacy. And they unfortunately lump those together. And so what you have here is finally, I started writing this paper and then I checked back in 2023, the fall of 2023, they updated it to 5 signals and they fixed this problem. Finally, they disaggregated when you have some evidence of no effect or potentially problematic effects versus you have no studies, you have no rigorous studies. Or you have conflicting studies, the gray. And so in this classification, I think it emphasizes sometimes the difficulty in correctly informing consumers about what they might gain from trying something. So you could see a patient very rationally wanting to try a treatment that has either no evidence, so they have no idea what it is. It could be good, it could be bad,
That could be beneficial experimentation. They could also have something that has conflicting evidence. They don't want to probably try something for which many rigorous studies have been done and no evidence has been found. That's a very different probative value. But a patient might come in believing that originally they only want green procedures. And if after a couple of failed treatments, they decide that they actually want green and yellow, it's not to say that it's a problem, not to say that they're wrong. But a conversation needs to be had. A physician should not be able to waive their obligation to discuss the change in those preferences. They should have to have a conversation. And that's the essence of my proposal is we need to impose an obligation to discuss the reasons for a change in preferences, never stopping anyone from doing anything. But the obligation for the physician to talk through those differences is really what's at stake here. The second context in which I think this is important is in financing innovation. So I talk about shared risk in the paper, and I think this is an easier way to visually think about this. So let's say I'm purchasing a bundle of three rounds of IVF between this bundle and a shared risk program. You can see the bundle, in order for a clinic to break even, is cheaper than the shared risk, because in the event that none of these three rounds actually lead to a successful implantation, I get a refund under shared risk. That refund is somewhere between 60 and 80% of the cost. And so it has a lot of, it's supposed to provide some assurance for the patient. If in the bundle, if you get pregnant on the first round, you don't get a refund, right? You get a pregnancy. You don't get pregnant on the third round, no refund still, nothing there. So this shared risk has been gotten a lot of attention from legal scholars for many other reasons. Some people are concerned that they don't get a refund, even if they do get a child, which fundamentally misunderstands what it's doing here. Some of them think that it might be really great because then you have this bundle of money to kind of figure out your next step after this part of your fertility journey has ended. And that is how it's been marketed. These clinics would say, use it to start your adoption process. Use it for something else. Now, the hard part is this. Your eligibility to participate in a shared risk program usually requires that you've never had a failed implantation, period. So you could never buy another shared risk program. You can't dovetail those things. Now, what you could do is buy another a la carte round of IVF at the normal price. So potentially that is where they're sort of pushing you. Now, there are many reasons to like these sort of financing innovations. They might address access. Many of us don't have the money to upfront spend on these medical treatments, especially at US prices. But shared risk is not going to help with that. Shared risk is buying multiple rounds, so it doesn't increase access. It's always going to be more than one round of IVF, right? Its purpose is to provide multiple rounds. So it's not an access creating a bit. And I show in the appendix that basically, if you were to look at the minimum prices that have to be charged for a clinic to break even, no patient that has risk-averse preferences would prefer the shared risk program at the price it has to set to the bundle. So if they were given their druthers, a risk-averse patient of any degree of risk aversion actually, would prefer to have a bundle. They don't want to have that refund. They prefer to have an upfront lower cost. And so when we think about if it's there to help with patients' risk aversion, it seems like the answer might not be yes. So then you might want to ask yourself, well, why is it there? And one plausible story is, once I start this and I get my refund, I put my refund into a la carte IVF treatments because now I have a treatment failure and my willingness to pay escalates. So when thinking about this experience-sensitive preference, I think of it in two ways. It can either be something like a sunk cost, where I think of my next cost as a proportion of the cumulative cost I've already spent. Can also be kind of like a gambler's fallacy. I believe after a string of failures that a win is owed. And so my beliefs over the success of that next trial are just incredibly high. And there's been some social science to kind of document this, particularly in the fertility context. And so this is my concern here. There's no stopgap here. Clinics don't have any incentive to on their own educate patients about this. This is kind of an unstoppable train. So my proposal is that we actually don't look at the common law for answers. We don't look at informed consent, enforced informed consent. Instead, we use a lot of the literature surrounding shared decision-making and patient decision-making aids. So shared decision-making has evolved as an alternative to informed consent. And it's not really a legal framework. It's kind of an ethical framework, but some states have incorporated it into their torts system by using it as a safe harbor. So if I've engaged in a process of shared decision-making, I might not be able to be sued for certain things. So a couple of states have done something like that. My proposal is different because I don't want the threat of litigation to be the impetus, because I think ultimately it's an incredible threat. Litigation probably won't happen anyway, and so I don't know how strong of a lever that would be. So instead, I'm using the mechanisms of shared decision-making, the use of these automated patient decision aids, to create an obligation for certification. And I use that pretty broadly because it can happen in three ways, and it would look different if we do it in each of those three ways. But ultimately, it would be the clinic's obligation to show compliance with that, with using this patient decision aid in order to be certified. And I'll get into what that means in a second. But the idea behind a patient decision aid is that it's usually an app of some sort that walks a patient and a physician through some very accessible questions that capture the heart of what is at stake here. So I have here a decision aid that was published by Yamamoto about end-of-life care. So he has here two options. You can either undergo full treatment or discontinue treatment that might prolong your life. And he goes through, you know, in little graphics, in very low level reading, talk about, you know, what are the relative benefits and risks of each. So for a continent of treatment, not essential to live as long as possible, even if the treatment involves, it's more essential to live as long as possible, even if the treatment involves more physical or mental stress. Alternatively, instead of hoping that treatment will prolong your life, the focus is on relieving pain as much as possible and walking through various dimensions of this treatment. So you're more likely to return to your previous life if you do full treatment, whereas you will not be able to, you know, perform daily activities if you don't do the full treatment and instead do more palliative care. And so it's a very, when things are the same, it shows that. And it really visually kind of shows, it walks the patient through this context. The strengths here are, one, physicians don't come up with this. So there's a lot of evidence that physicians aren't that numerically savvy, and it's tough for them to keep up with all of the new evidence that comes out on a daily basis. And so if we're looking to physicians to come up with this sort of information to disclose a patient, that is, I think, beggaring belief. It's just not going to happen. And also, physicians have the same issue that humans do and trying to figure out ways to communicate uncertainty. So if you leave that to actually the promulgators of the patient decision aids, that might be a better way to communicate. The other nice thing is that these are usually uniform. So people adopt patient decision aids. An institution will adopt a patient decision aid. And so if you have a physician who has been out of school for 50 years and a physician who has just graduated, they have access and are able to use the same tool to update basically their information about available techniques. So how this would work here is at the beginning of a fertility treatment, you elicit potential preferences over future treatments. So you might say in the IVF context for rounds, say, how many rounds are you anticipating being willing to go through? Of course, you could always do less, but what do you think your max is right now? When you think about innovative treatment, you might think, well, there are some techniques out there that have a lot of robust evidence out there. Some are more experimental, show the difference between, you know, what are the benefits of participating in them? What are the costs? In a very broad sense. But then get lower bound of where they're originally thinking that they're willing to go. And that's it. For each round of treatment, then, you re-elicit these preferences. And when they differ, all you have to do is have a conversation about the reasons. So if the reasons end up being something more like, well, we've come so far, what's a little bit more? A physician might want to have a longer conversation about that. Versus, you know, while I'm realizing that my biological state is actually needing a more extreme intervention. That's something we learned in these tests. And now with that information, I think it's definitely worthwhile to go on further. Those are two different kind of reasons. Nothing here ever prevents a patient from choosing whatever it is they choose. The obligation is only on the physician to have that conversation, a conversation that is not otherwise incentivized by the common law. All right, so this is the kind of example for end-of-life care. And if we were to adapt it to our context, you could think of, you know, what are the maximum number of IVF rounds you're willing to complete? What type of interventions are you willing to undertake? And you kind of think of it this way, in this judgment, how important is reliability of the data supporting the treatment? And this judgment, how important is avoiding unknown side effects? And this judgment, how important is not excluding innovative treatments? Of course, I'm not the person to write these things, so this is what I've come up with. Much smarter people than I should be doing this. But it can be accessible. It can be a bit less opaque. The reasons that I am advocating using something like this is there's already a great deal of information on PDAs out there. This is a burgeoning field, and it does manage to do quite a lot. So we have other work looking at expressing uncertain risks and imperfect data using a variation of a Cates plot, which is the way that physicians are representing risk using smiley faces and frowny faces. But these like very small sample representations of the differences in outcomes are very effective in communicating the relative difference for patients who might not be numerically that savvy or might hate numbers entirely. There's a very high level of innumeracy in the US. So this is a common problem. So the second issue is that, you know, this is actually not creating a burden on providers. It is not, I think, artificially believing that providers have this information, are ready to talk through this information on the fly, or are equally willing to have that information. So instead, on having this uniform app that they will go through, it will kind of even the playing field here. The other kind of dynamic at play is, in the U.S. at least, healthcare is becoming more institutional. So we have fewer physicians operating on their own. They're often with the institution. And the probability of institutional liability is becoming higher. People are more willing to go after hospitals or a clinic kind of umbrella than the actual physician. And so if the hospital faces that pressure, they might be more incentivized to adopt these kind of disclosures to minimize their liability risk more generally. The benefits also is that it's a soft nudge. I think this is an area where a stricter rule would be inappropriate. There's just no way ex ante to know what a person would actually accept. And so this is a place for a soft nudge. And the other value here is that it acknowledges that each treatment really varies by time and experience. So if I were to go through three rounds of IVF and I only agreed to two, and I'm thinking about the third one, technically, from a physician's perspective, they've already notified me of all the risks and benefits of IVF. But that's not really the question here, right? The question is, do I want to go further? And there's no new disclosure from an informed consent perspective. And yet there's so much disclosure that's necessary. There's so much guidance that a patient wants at that point, but a provider has no obligation to provide. And acknowledging that difference, I think, shows us some of the limitations, at least currently, of informed consent doctrine. All right, so then in terms of enforcing this, we have a couple of options. You can go the private accreditation route. So if you can say, Well, if you, as an organization or a group of physicians, adopt this tool, then you have an accreditation saying that you are such and such certified, and that would provide a signal to patients that maybe you care about them. Half of these websites, you know, they really stress this idea that we care about you. We want this kind of interpersonal relationship. And this is a context where patients are paying out of pocket for it. And so they might be very willing to shop around in a way that maybe they don't do for other healthcare purposes because insurance is that intermediary and often contractually makes them only have a subset of people available to them. The nice thing about this is that we could actually implement it. There would be no governmental regulation to be a problem. Of course, weakness is that for private accreditation in general, always concerned about them being too friendly to clinics because they're voluntary. And so I could basically give a signal of a regulation that's pretty much empty so that I get enough clinics to sign on, tell my students that's always the issue when you're trying to become accreditation a unit, you wanna be business friendly. And so then the standard that you're setting might not be that high. You can go with state licensing. Technically, health and safety is all states' rights. So the ability for the federal government to intervene is limited, which I'll talk about in a second. But I mean, that's precisely the issue. We just had the Alabama Supreme Court declare that an embryo has personhood, legal personhood, and that shut down all of the IVF clinics in Alabama until the legislature could basically say, yes, yes, embryos are people, but you're immunized from liability if you work in fertility, which is the most bizarre way to go about whatever it is they were trying to do in that context. So leaving it to states might be politically a bit more risky because we have precisely states often working against the interests of their population. Now, the one thing is fertility patients tend to be more richer and maybe they pay more attention. Clearly in Alabama that worked because they quickly passed that legislation. A lot of pro-life people are actively seeking IVF, and so that's an issue for them. So I don't know. But the weakness is, of course, that it'll be a variable coverage. For federal spending, this has changed since Dobbs. So post-Dobbs, I think there is a very weak ground for the federal government to say that they have the ability to regulate more generally. Usually they thought there used to be a bit more of a veneer of authority coming from that privacy right, the ability to reproduce part of that privacy right and not reproduce. Now, courts just seem to think, I'm not optimistic that will cover it up far, but I think that's pretty much gone. What they have done in the past is they have used this as a reporting requirement. So currently there is legislation to report success rates for all fertility clinics. It's very narrow. So you could make compliance with this PDA a reporting requirement and have that just be that. Or you could just pay them to do it, which is how we do a lot of this regulation. So through the spending clause, just say, you have money if you adopt this. But these are the three ways I see going forward. I don't see a state implementation being successful just because the people who probably need it probably won't get it. It's better to be uniform. So my money's on the federal, but I have lots of thoughts about this. So that is where I'll end. Please, any questions or feedbacks or thoughts would be very helpful. Thank you.
February 13th is World Radio Day, where millions around the globe celebrate the medium which touches so many lives. All across this country, Canadians are celebrating too, including Farm Radio International and the National Campus and Community Radio Association, with a live broadcast through CKCU-FM from Ottawa. Learn more and participate in World Radio Day at worldradioday.ncra.ca on February 13th and catch the live stream.
On Saturday, March 8 at 7 p.m., join the Agnes Etherington Art Center as they bring back their popular series, Open Secret. In this third edition, the Agnes partners with New York Film Festival, Prismatic Ground, and its artistic director, Inay Prakash, for a screening of five short works by filmmakers exploring the gaps in their relationships to ancestral homelands, including the earth upon which Canada has imposed its borders. From Palestine to Algeria to Haiti to China, the faint outlines of nations dissolve beneath a vivid 16-millimeter overlay of memory and imagination. A Q&A with Prakash will follow the screenings. This event is free and takes place at the screening room. Save your spot today by visiting agnes.queensu.ca.
Down the short set of stairs, join me, Grim, in the basement for my working knowledge of